Media Network Plus, produced and presented by Keith Perron.
Hello and welcome to the program. If you tuned in 2 weeks ago, you may remember the story that we ran on a radio station in Mosul, that was actually in Mosul, broadcasting to people ISIS activities. The station was set up covertly, and of course Mohammed, which was not his real name, was moving the transmitter around and the radio station around so they wouldn't get caught by ISIS. Now, broadcasting into Syria is actually something that is quite important because of the civil war that has been raging for the past few years. The ABC's Maeve Francis visited the Turkish border to meet some local journalists who are using the more traditional medium of radio to connect and deliver news to those still inside Syria. Now, I should mention, of course, that radio is not the only means that's being used, but also social media. Here's Maeve Francis.
صباح الخير مستمعينا أولى فقرات برنامج يسعد صباحك يا بلد جونا لليوم 14 تموز.
It's 10 a.m. in the Turkish city of Gaziantep and radio presenter Mais Basha is midway through the morning program. Basha fields calls from listeners, discusses the latest soccer match and reads the news.
شمال سوريا في إدلب 32-21 الجو صحو.
It's all pretty standard really, except it's not.
وسط سوريا صحو أيضا في حمص 32-19 وحماة 34-22.
The station, which is called Nasaim Surya, isn't broadcasting to Gaziantep, Turkey's sixth largest city, but across the border into neighboring Syria.
غائم جزئيا في اللاذقية ودرجة.
Gaziantep is 60 kilometers from the Turkish border, and the bustling Turkish city has become a de facto base for exiled Syrian media organizations. Nasaim Syria is one of many opposition media outlets with their base in Turkey. Program coordinator Wihad Weiss shows me around. The station has a staff of around 15 people.
You're 15? Almost 15, 17. We have some people, they are just new to media. They train themselves. It's most of them, they used to be students at universities. This is the editing room.
This is the studio.
Yes. So this is the morning program called Good Morning Our Country, besides Sabahak Ya Balad. It's supposed to be 3 hours, but during Ramadan it's very hard for the announcer to speak for 3 hours. So now it's just 2 hours. It starts from 10 to 12 o'clock.
Okay, and what kind of things do you have in the morning program, like news and...
It includes news. We speak about economic, the prices of the Syrian pound today when you compare it with dollars, with euros. They have what happened today.
During the news bulletin, the show airs pieces from their reporters still inside Syria.
It's very hard for them. You know, every day we just worried. We hear bombs, attacks, airplanes. So we just call themselves, are you okay? Yes, we are okay. Every day, this is daily work. Yeah.
The risks for journalists inside Syria are immense. Last year, the Committee to Protect Journalists named Syria as the most dangerous place in the world to be a reporter. Over 70 journalists have been killed reporting on the conflict. The majority of them have been Syrian.
نبلش الثورة السورية.
Reem Halabi is the director and founder of Nasaim Syria. She tells me that to understand why they take these risks, you have to go back to the beginning, the start of the revolution.
For 2 weeks there were no communication, no media, no electricity, no internet, and people wanted to know exactly what was happening inside Aleppo. But nobody knew because the media was controlled by the regime. The only thing I could use was the radio, so I turned on the radio to see if there was anything. All I heard was Turkish radio, and the coverage was good, I could hear them well in Aleppo. At this point, I thought, why don't we have a radio with a radio transmitter in Turkey, and people could know what is happening in this country.
It took a while for Reem to realize that goal. Instead, Nasaim Syria started with a small bureau in Aleppo.
We started with a small staff, four people, and we grew bigger each month.
Reem wasn't the only one with this idea. Syrian citizen journalists all over the country were documenting their revolution.
I'm from Aleppo, 25 years old.
Amru al-Halibi was one of these journalists. He was 23 when the uprising began.
Yeah, it started at the first beginning of the revolution, so there was no one shooting videos for the protests, so I took my cell phone and I started to shoot videos, upload them on YouTube and broadcast live protests. It was amazing, so basically every video that I shooted was broadcasted on TV channels, major TV channels in Arabic media. Because we were making change, we were affecting on the media, the public opinion and everything. So basically we managed to affect the world, international community, our local community, and we really gave a great push to the revolution.
Back then, the Middle East was still in the heady grip of the Arab Spring. Many Syrians felt that Syria would be no different, that once the international community saw the evidence, they'd have to intervene.
Yeah. Well, actually, I started to shoot videos using my smartphone. It was real stupid. It was only 5 megapixels, sorry, and I was uploading them through my 3G. So sometimes my 3G will be off because I didn't pay the bill. So, and that's how it starts. Then after 3 months, someone gave me a really good cell phone. So I started to shoot more and more videos. And when the liberation started and we had liberated areas, then we got some funding for really great cameras.
Amro's reports were broadcast all over the world, but as the war dragged on, it became a whole lot more complicated. The opposition, which began as an inclusive military force of different brigades, fighting under the unifying name of the Free Syrian Army, began to splinter. New brigades were formed with a much more conservative outlook, and they weren't so kind to Syria's burgeoning new media. The most radical of these new players is the State of Iraq in the Levant, now known as the Islamic State. Back at the studios of Nasaim Syria, Reem Halabi explains to me what that meant for the media on the ground, for their small team at the Aleppo Bureau.
Our bureau in Aleppo is not afraid of aerial bombardment of the regime forces. The main fear became arrest and kidnapping from ISIS. So we closed our Aleppo office and our reporters on the ground worked alone from their houses. We use pseudonyms for them, which we have to change all the time.
Nasaim Syria isn't the only outlet struggling to fulfill an enormous task. Across town from the Nasaim Syria studios, I meet Rami Jara from Ana Press.
We gathered because we managed to sit on one table because we know each other's work. We know that everyone on this table is serious.
He's gathered with some other station directors to try and discuss the issues facing each media organization. There's Sirwan.
Yes, Sirwan Hussein, Arta FM.
From Arta FM, which broadcasts in the Kurdish north of the country, and...
My name is Adnan Haddad, Hara FM, that's currently broadcasting on the internet and in Aleppo.
Rami, Adnan and Sirwan are trying to establish an organization, which they've called Abraj, to aid stations in Syria as they face even greater logistical challenges keeping their reporters on air. Here's Adnan again.
Being a media activist or with the media is considered to be a crime by most of the factions in Syria now. Starting with the regime, who is, we consider to be the harshest of all, then moving to ISIS, moving to other fundamentalist groups, and even some of the FSA brigades. What we're trying to do is we're trying to work in actually the most dangerous place in the world. And we have to worry about each and every detail in terms of getting the equipments and keeping them working. And you know that you can't simply just install a transmitter and leave it there.
Transmitting on FM means that stations have to have radio transmitters inside Syria. The whole process, from smuggling them inside to protecting the transmitters once they're set up, is arduous. Nasaim Syria recently lost a transmitter in Aleppo to shelling. Other stations, like Ramiz Ana Radio, have had theirs stolen or broken by militants or looters.
In some areas, it's possible, but it means that you have to pay off people. You have to have a battalion that can secure it. We have ways of hiding the equipment. We have to buy more expensive equipment that's smaller, that we can hide in different places, not putting them inside cows or anything, but there is a way that we're hiding them. And that means that means extra expenses, and that's the issue of independence again.
کسی مال آخرون اشتیه کسی بریاد رویه آرتا اف ام دنگیت هیویه ایواره تبخیر مال با
ایواره تبخیر صفقان ایواره همو گوه داره بخیر به نرگز و شلیر به
گوروان
لبه بارانی افی حاتن سر و لاتیمه
بلی براستیم جیب هیوی
This is the media report on RN. I'm Richard Aidy and you're listening to a report on the challenges of covering the Syrian conflict for a Syrian audience. Interestingly, the medium that's proving to be the most valuable and effective is radio, which means transmitters are crucial. Rami Jara, co-founder of Ana Radio, is planning a new one.
It would be located in an area called Khan Safra in Idlib, and it would, I can't give the exact location, but it would be somewhere there. It's a high area that's in between Idlib, Aleppo, Latakia, Homs and Hama. So this really covers most of the areas, and it reaches the coastal region, which is a vital area that the regime controls.
Broadcasting into regime-controlled areas is new for the station, and it requires a different kind of programming.
Exactly, but what this gives us is a responsibility to sort of adapt with our content to these areas. So we can't provide anti-regime content. We have to be very neutral, and I think a lot of comedy.
For Sirwan, the key has been getting the community involved. The war has shattered entire villages, and Sirwan hopes that radio, a medium that all over the world has flourished at a community level, can help bring those communities back together.
You know, we used to have only one source of information, and this source was in Damascus. It was a media which was influenced by the regime. And suddenly, now after starting the revolution inside Syria, now we have a new experience. People now have really a voice. They can make their own programs. We have young people who never had experience with media, with radio. Suddenly, they are making programs. And so Syrians are making program for themselves, not for a regime, not for a political party, not for for the revolution, not for just for themselves.
And they're competing with much larger media operations. The Assad regime has the power of a well-oiled state-run media behind them. And the Islamic State has a huge media presence on social media, YouTube, and in the areas of Syria and Iraq that they control. These are not grainy cell phone videos or simple websites. The Islamic State have their own channels, radio stations, and even an online English language magazine. They produce high-quality content shot on top-of-the-line gear.
In the face of the dark wave of the Crusader force, the historical land of two rivers bore life to a mission that would transform the political landscape of the world.
This is an excerpt from Flames of War, a 55-minute film released by the group in September. A narrator speaks over images of war of George Bush. The video is one of hundreds produced by the group.
Thus, the war between Iman and Kufr was ignited.
These videos are a large part of their recruitment strategy, and they are very keen to keep control of their image. If this means intimidating local journalists, then so be it. Mohammed, who doesn't want to use his full name, sits in a busy restaurant in Rahanle, a dusty border town 200 kilometers south of Gaziantep. Earlier this year, he was on a scouting trip for a new channel when he ran into the Islamic State.
There was a checkpoint. A checkpoint for ISIS, and they check our car. They found my laptop and a microphone. I tried to tell them that this microphone was not for me, it was for my friend. Then they found my camera and my two-way, so they said, "This means you're a media worker." He hit me with the butt of his rifle and made me go with them.
The fighters released Mohammed's driver and took him to their base.
They blindfolded me and they drove me for 30 to 45 minutes and put me in a room. They took all my stuff and an Egyptian guy came in. He asked for my Facebook and Skype accounts. He opened the accounts and let me for 3 hours. He came back with many accounts open on my laptop. He asked me, "How many accounts do you have?" I said they are my friends' accounts. And they said, "You're a liar," and began to beat me.
Mohammed was held for a week and subject to many more beatings. He was fed one meal a day and at night.
I realized there was another person taking a beating in the room next to me. I could hear him screaming, "Don't hit me, don't hit me." Every evening they would come into my room. And on the final day at night time, one of them came into the room and said, "Come with us." But I couldn't walk, so a big guy came to carry me. And they put me in the trunk of their car. They drove me around 1.5 hours. And in the car, I was thinking of the ISIS execution videos I had seen. I was praying. I thought they were going to kill me. When we arrived, I thought, "This is where they're going to kill me." They let me, and I managed to untie my hands and took off my blindfold. And I started walking.
Since I began reporting this story, the Islamic State has taken even more ground. They publicly beheaded two American journalists and circulated brutal and graphic videos of their murders online. The Assad regime has continued fighting the opposition, and more than 15,000 civilians have been killed. Foreign journalists now are rarely able to report from on the ground. So most of the news you see coming out of Syria now, it's come from local reporters.
Freedom to us, especially, you know, being media activists, freedom to us is, you know, starting with the freedom of media. All kind of freedoms in Syria have been oppressed by the regime. And we know if we, you know, make sure at least the freedom of speech, the freedom of expression is, you know, kept alive, then we have hopes for, you know, other freedoms to be won.
Arta FM.
That was Maeve Francis reporting from the Turkish border on broadcasting into Syria. You're listening to Media Network Plus, coming to you from PCJ Radio International.
The Spectrum Monitor is a monthly electronic magazine covering shortwave, amateur radio, scanning, satellites, Wi-Fi, and vintage radio, which is available for any device capable of opening a PDF file. The Spectrum Monitor also covers amateur radio satellites, maritime and military monitoring on shortwave, reviews of receivers, scanners, and software used for shortwave, and more. Annual subscriptions for 12 issues is only $24, with individual monthly issues available for $3 each. If you're already a subscriber, you can renew your subscription by clicking on the Sign Up for 2015 button. MasterCard, Visa, Discover, and PayPal are accepted. For more details, visit our website at www.thespectrummonitor.com.
Governments from about 10 Pacific countries have helped put together a guidebook on human rights reporting. The book, once published, will be used as a tool to help individual countries in the region report back to international bodies on how they're measuring up to the treaties they've signed on to. Romulio Nacovalo is a senior human rights advisor from the Pacific Community's Regional Rights Resource Team. He spoke to Indira Stewart.
One of the challenges to treaty reporting that we've identified in the Pacific is the lack of tools for our governments to be able to use to assist them. And therefore, through this project, we've identified that one of the practical ways to actually assist in treaty reporting is to provide a guide around indicators. And we're here this week to validate the final product before we finalize and get it to the governments.
So when you, just to clarify, when you say treaty reporting, are you saying in terms of reporting on human rights?
That's correct. As you are aware, there are 9 core human rights treaties, and Pacific Island countries are state parties to at least 2 or 3 of the core treaties. And part of the obligations of being state parties is you need to report on progresses that have happened in a significant number of areas. And so these indicators provide a guide to Pacific states as they prepare to report to keep measuring. Unless the countries have actually ratified a treaty, they are not obliged to report on it. So this is part of the legal obligations of ratification. They submit a 4-year periodic report. So it is these periodic reports that are required to be submitted to the Human Rights Council committees or the expert committees that we often face numerous challenges in. And so these indicators are hoping to provide that pointer. They are also universal indicators, but we're hoping to contextualize it more to the Pacific. There are minimum universal standards, and we work on those bases to ensure that we're able to capture the data that is required.
In terms of making these indicators unique to the Pacific region, is there something about cultures in the Pacific region that make reporting on this issue different to the rest of the world?
Yes, you know, we have cultural practices, and cultural rights are protected rights. And so it's about how you communicate that, how you translate that, in terms of your own reporting. And so you'll see that in the treaties, countries are required to engage on these aspects of, on different aspects of culture. And of course, looking at cultural practices that may challenge the spirit of the treaties, and then how do you address that and how do you react to that? And so in terms of cultural context, we're also trying to see what aspect of cultural context we can write indicators for.
Do you foresee that the Pacific region will endeavour to sign and ratify the remaining human rights treaties?
That's actually a great question. It's a question that we continue to even put to governments at our consultations. But it's one thing to actually ratify treaties. It's another then to meet, for example, especially the reporting obligations. A lot of the treaties, even those that they have not yet ratified, like torture, etc., are already enshrined protections in national legislations and national constitutions. So for most of them, it's just the burden, the financial burden that comes, I guess, with reporting, because that's a big work. We're talking about countries with limited technical expertise around reporting, limited financial expertise. But again, as I've said earlier, over the years, we see that there's a lot of improvements to that. So I do see that, you know, countries, as they confront the issue of reporting, will actually move to ratifying treaties. But it's really a lot of consideration and factors to be taken into before states should actually move into ratification.
This past Thursday, the BBC World Service announced that it will unveil new programs and services. Now, of course, this has to do with a boost to their annual funding. Now, what is interesting about this, if you go back over the last 20 years, and look at the BBC World Service, the ABC, the Australian Broadcasting Corporation, and the CBC, the Canadian Broadcasting Corporation, and also some other public broadcasters, you will see the same kind of trend. Usually what you will have is a big budget cut that will take place that will eliminate services. It will eliminate programs. Very often, the services that are eliminated are services that are either no longer needed or don't reach the audience that perhaps they once did. So that staff is let go, and also those who are closer to retirement. And then usually maybe 2 or 3 years will go by, and then they get either a budget increase or things kind of level off, and then they start introducing new services. So what the BBC is doing right now is no different to what has happened, like I said, at the ABC and the CBC. Now, as of yet, there is no idea, but they're suspected to make the announcement very soon of the new programs that will be coming into the World Service. Some of them are going to be a new weekly podcast that will cover the latest on the film industry from Hollywood to Bollywood to Nollywood. I don't know if that's the name of the show. It's kind of catchy. A new series is going to be called Crowd Science. That's going to be launched in November. The Art Hour is going to be taking the program on the road once a month, as well as some other things. The other area that the BBC World Service is expanding it is their digital network. So listeners can download programs and not just have to listen to them through the BBC World Service. Also, they're going to be bringing some video, animation, and interactive content through their new digital platform. As more information about this comes about, we will pass it along. But now let's take a look at propagation, what's been happening, and what we can expect. Here's our propagation editor, Glenn Hauser.
Keith from IPS in Australia, the global HF propagation forecast through November 16th. Normal to fair at low and middle latitude bands, fair at high latitudes. From space weather in South Africa through November 26th, magnetic conditions active to unsettled, shortwave fadeouts unlikely, MUF unstable. From Met Office UK through November 27th, solar activity very low, geomagnetic field unsettled to active, with some isolated minor storms. From Peter Coleman in Prague, the geomagnetic field will be active to disturbed November 25th to 26th, quiet to unsettled November 27th to 30th, December 5th, 6th, and 11th. Mostly quiet on December 1st and 12th. Quiet on December 2nd to 4th and 13th and 14th. Quiet to active December 7th to 10th. From Space Weather Canada, most quiet magnetic activity in the polar and auroral zones December 1st to 6th. From SWPC in Boulder, geomagnetic field unsettled to active November 21st to 29th and December 7th to 11th. ANK indices declining from 20 and 4 on November 25th to 5 and 2 November 30th to December 6th, then rising to 20 and 4 on December 10th. Solar flux peaking at 84 from December 2nd to 4th and down to 75 by December 15th. William Hepburn's VHF, UHF, microwave DX maps show extreme tropospheric ducting off the coast of Ecuador November 25th to 27th. Off the coasts of Angola and Namibia, November 25th to 28th. Off the central west coast of India and the northwest coast of Australia, all week to November 29th.
Thanks a lot, Glenn. And with that, we've come to the end of the program. Our email address is mnp@pcjmedia.com. If you wish to listen to this program again or catch past editions, you can visit our website, pcjmedia.com, and click on the link for Media Network Plus. On behalf of the whole team, I'm Keith Powell, wishing you well, saying so long, take care. We'll see you in 7 days. 73 and 88 to the ladies.